Welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's narration is Indian Atrocities, Narratives of the Perils and Sufferings of Dr. Knight and John Slover among the Indians during the Revolutionary War, with short memoirs of Colonel Crawford and John Slover, and a letter from H. Brackenridge on the rights of the Indians. And this was published in 1867. The first edition of these narratives was printed in Pittsburgh in 1782 in pamphlet form. A copy can hardly be procured now at any price. Another small edition was printed in Nashville in 1843, which has become exceedingly scarce. It is hoped that this reprint may prove acceptable to all interested in the early history of our country and the struggles of the pioneers with the Indians. 500 copies only are printed of this edition. To the public. The two following narratives were transmitted for publication in September last, but shortly afterwards the letters from Sir Guy Carleton to His Excellency General Washington, informing that the savages had received orders to desist from their incursions, gave reason to hope that there will be an end to their barbarities. For this reason it was not thought necessary to hold up to view what they had heretofore done. But as they still continue their murders on our frontier, these narratives may be serviceable to induce our government to take some effectual steps to chastise and suppress them, as from hence they will see that the nature of an Indian is fierce and cruel, and that an extirpation of them would be useful to the world and honourable to those who can effect it. August 3rd, 1782. Letter. Mr. Bailey, enclosed are two narratives, one of Dr. Knight, who acted as surgeon in the expedition under Colonel Crawford, and the other of John Slover. That of Dr. Knight was written by himself at my request. That of Slover was taken by myself from his mouth as he related it. This man, from his childhood, lived amongst the Indians. Though perfectly sensible and intelligent, yet he cannot write. The character of Dr. Knight is well known to be that of a good man, of strict veracity, of a calm and deliberate mind, and using no exaggeration in his account of any matter. As a testimony in favour of the veracity of Slover, I thought proper to procure a certificate from the clergyman to whose church he belongs, and which I give below. By H. Brackenridge. I do hereby certify that John Slover has been for many years a regular member of the church under my care and is worthy of the highest credit. William Renault, Pittsburgh, August 3rd, 1782. The Narrative of Dr. Knight. About the latter end of the month of March or the beginning of April of the present year, 1781, the Western Indians began to make incursions upon the frontiers of Ohiogan and Washington, Youghiogheny and Westmoreland counties, which has been their constant practice ever since the commencement of the present war between the United States and Great Britain. In consequence of these predatory invasions, the principal officers of the above-mentioned counties, namely Colonels Williamson and Marshall, tried every method in their power to set on foot an expedition against the Wyandot towns, which they could effect no other way than by giving all possible encouragement to volunteers. The plan proposed was as follows. Every man furnishing himself with a horse, a gun, and 1 month's provisions should be exempt from 2 tours of militia duty. Likewise, that everyone who had been plundered by the Indians should, if the plunder could be found at their towns, have it again, proving it to be his property, and all horses lost on the expedition by unavoidable accident were to be replaced by horses taken in the enemy's country. The time appointed for the rendezvous or general meeting of the volunteers was fixed to be on the 20th of May, and the place, the old Mingo town on the west side of the River Ohio, about 40 miles below Fort Pitt by land and, I think, about 75 by water. Colonel Crawford was solicited by the general voice of these western counties and districts to command the expedition. He accordingly set out as a volunteer and came to Fort Pitt 2 days before the time appointed for the assembling of the men. As there was no surgeon yet appointed to go with the expedition, Colonel Crawford begged the favour of General Irvin to permit me to accompany him, my consent having been previously asked, to which the general agreed, providing Colonel Gibson did not object. Having obtained permission of the colonel, I left Fort Pitt on Tuesday, May 1st, and the next day, about 1 in the afternoon, arrived at the Mingo Bottom. The volunteers had not at all crossed the river until Friday morning, the 24th. They then distributed themselves into 18 companies, choosing their captains by vote. There were chosen also one Colonel Commandant, 4 Field, and 1 Brigadier Major. There were 465 that voted. We began our march on Saturday, May 25th, making almost a due west course, and on the fourth day reached the old Moravian town upon the River Muskingum, about 60 miles from the River Ohio. Some of the men, having lost their horses on the night preceding, returned home. Thursday the 28th in the evening, Major Brenton and Captain Bean went some distance from camp to reconnoitre. Having gone about 1/4 of a mile, they saw 2 Indians, upon whom they fired, and then retreated to camp. This was the first place in which we were discovered, as we understood afterwards. On Thursday the 4th of June, which was the 11th day of our march, about 1 o'clock we came to the spot where the town of Sandusky formerly stood. The inhabitants had moved 18 miles lower down the creek, nearer the lower Sandusky, but as neither our guides or any who were with us had known anything of their removal, we began to conjecture. There were no Indian towns nearer than the lower Sandusky, which was at least 40 miles distant. However, after refreshing our horses, we advanced on search of some of their settlements, but had scarcely got the distance of 3 or 4 miles from the old town when a number of our men expressed their desire to return, some of them alleging that they had only 5 days' provisions, upon which the field officers and captains determined in council to proceed that afternoon and no longer. Previous to the calling of this council, a small party of light horse had been sent forward to reconnoitre. I shall here remark, by the way, that there are a great many extensive plains in that country. The woods in general grow very thin and free from brush and underwood, so that light horsemen may advance a considerable distance before an army without being much exposed to the enemy. Just as the council decided, an express returned from the above-mentioned party of light horse with intelligence that they had been about 3 miles in front and had seen a large body of Indians running towards them. In a short time we saw the rest of the light horse who joined us, and having gone 1 mile further, met a number of Indians who had partly got possession of a piece of woods before us whilst we were in the plains, but our men, alighting from their horses and rushing into the woods, soon obliged them to abandon that place. The enemy, being by this time reinforced, flanked to the right, and part of them coming in nearer quickly made the action more serious. The firing continued very warm on both sides from 4 o'clock until the dusk of the evening, each party maintaining their ground. Next morning, about 6 o'clock, their guns were discharged at the distance of 200 or 300 yards, which continued till day, doing little or no execution on either side. The field officers then assembled and agreed, as the enemy were every moment increasing, and we had already a number of wounded, to retreat that night. The whole body was to form into 3 lines, keeping the wounded in the centre. We had 4 killed and 23 wounded, of the latter 7 very dangerously, on which account as many biers were got ready to carry them, most of the rest were slightly wounded, and none so bad, but they could ride on horseback. After dark, the officers went on the outposts and brought in all the men as expeditiously as they could. Just as the troops were about to form, several guns were fired by the enemy, upon which some of our men spoke out and said, "Our intention was discovered by the Indians, who were firing alarm guns." Upon which some in front hurried off and the rest immediately followed, leaving the seven men that were dangerously wounded, some of whom, however, got off on horseback by means of some good friends who waited for and assisted them. We had not got a quarter of a mile from the field of action when I heard Colonel Crawford calling for his son, John Crawford, his son-in-law, Major Harrison, Major Rose, and William Crawford, his nephews, upon which I came up and told him I believed they were on before us. He asked, "Was that the doctor?" I told him it was. He then replied they were not in front and begged of me not to leave him. I promised him I would not. We then waited and continued calling for these men till the troops had passed us. The colonel told me his horse had almost given out, and he could not keep up with the troops, and wished some of his best friends to remain with him. He then exclaimed against the militia for riding off in such an irregular manner and leaving some of the wounded behind, contrary to his orders. Presently there came two men riding after us, one of them an old man and the other a lad. We inquired if they had seen any of the above persons. They answered they had not. By this time there was a very hot firing before us, and as we judged, near where our main body must have been. Our course was then nearly southwest, but changing it we went north about 2 miles, the two men remaining in company with us. Judging ourselves to be now out of the enemy's lines, we took a due east course, taking care to keep at the distance of 15 or 20 yards apart, and directing ourselves by the North Star. The old man often lagged behind, and when this was the case never failed to call for us to halt for him. When we were near the Sandusky Creek, he fell 100 yards behind and bawled out, as usual, for us to halt. While we were preparing to reprimand him for making a noise, I heard an Indian halloo, as I thought, 150 yards from the man and partly behind him. After this, we did not hear the man call again. Neither did he ever come up to us any more. It was now past midnight, and about daybreak, Colonel Crawford's and the young man's horses gave out, and they left them. We pursued our journey eastwards, and about 2 o'clock fell in with Captain Biggs, who had carried Lieutenant Ashley from the field of action, who had been dangerously wounded. We then went on about the space of an hour, when a heavy rain coming on, we concluded it was best to encamp, as we were encumbered with the wounded officer. We then barked 4 or 5 trees, made an encampment and a fire, and remained there all that night. Next morning we again prosecuted our journey, and having gone about 3 miles, found a deer which had been recently killed. The meat was sliced from the bones, and bundled up in the skin, with a tomahawk lying by it. We carried all with us, and in advancing about 1 mile further, espied the smoke of a fire. We then gave the wounded officer into the charge of the young man, directing him to stay behind, whilst the colonel, the captain, and myself walked up as cautiously as we could towards the fire. When we came to it, we concluded from several circumstances some of our people had encamped there the preceding night. We then went about roasting the venison, and when just about to march, observed one of our men coming upon our tracks. He seemed at first very shy, but having called to him, he came up and told us he was the person who had killed the deer, but upon hearing us come up, was afraid of Indians. He hid it in a thicket and made off. Upon this, we gave him some bread and roasted venison, and proceeded altogether on our journey. About 2 o'clock came upon the paths by which we had gone out. Captain Biggs and myself did not think it safe to keep the road, but the colonel said the Indians would not follow the troops further than the plains, which we were then considerably past. As the wounded officer rode Captain Biggs' horse, I lent the captain mine. The colonel and myself went about 100 yards in front, the captain and the wounded officer in the centre, and the two young men behind. After we had travelled about 1.5 miles, several Indians started up within 15 or 20 steps of the colonel and me. as we at first discovered only three, I immediately got behind a large black oak, made ready my piece, and raised it up to take sight, when the colonel called to me twice not to fire. Upon that, one of the Indians ran up to the colonel and took him by the hand. They were Delaware Indians of the Wingenim tribe. Captain Biggs fired amongst them, but did no execution. They then told us to call these people and make them come there, else they would go and kill them, which the colonel did, but they forgot us and escaped for that time. The colonel and I were then taken to the Indian camp, which was about half a mile from the place where we were captured. On Sunday evening, five Delawares who had posted themselves at some distance further on the road brought back to the camp where we lay Captain Biggs and Lieutenant Ashley's scalps, with an Indian scalp, which Captain Biggs had taken in the field of action. They also brought in Biggs' horse and mine, and they told us the other two men got away from them. Monday morning, the 10th of June, we were paraded to march to Sandusky, about 33 miles distant. They had 11 prisoners of us and 4 scalps, the Indians being 17 in number. Colonel Crawford was very desirous to see a certain Simon Gertie, who lived with the Indians, and was on this account permitted to go to town the same night with 2 warriors to guard him, having orders at the same time to pass by the place where the colonel had turned out his horse, that they might, if possible, find him. The rest of us were taken as far as the old town, which was within 8 miles of the new. Tuesday morning, the 11th, Colonel Crawford was brought out to us on purpose, to be marched in with the other prisoners. I asked the colonel if he had seen Mr. Gertie. He told me he had, and that Gertie had promised to do everything in his power for him, but that the Indians were very much enraged against the prisoners, particularly Captain Pipe, one of the chiefs. He likewise told me that Gertie had informed him that his son-in-law, Colonel Harrison, and his nephew, William Crawford, were made prisoners by the Shawnees, but had been pardoned. This Captain Pipe had come from the town about an hour before Colonel Crawford and had painted all the prisoners' faces black. As he was painting me, he told me I should go to the Shawnees towns and see my friends. When the colonel arrived, he painted him black also, told him he was glad to see him, and that he would have him shaved when he came to see his friends at the Wyandot town. When we marched, the colonel and I were kept back between Pipe and Wingenim, the 2 Delaware chiefs. The other 9 prisoners were sent forward with another party of Indians. As we went along, we saw 4 of the prisoners lying by the path, tomahawked and scalped. Some of them were at the distance of half a mile from each other. When we arrived within half a mile of the place where the colonel was executed, we overtook the 5 prisoners that remained alive. The Indians had caused them to sit down on the ground, as they did also the colonel and me at some distance from them. I was there given in charge to an Indian fellow to be taken to the Shawnees towns. In the place where we were now made to sit down, there were a number of squaws and boys who fell on the 5 prisoners and tomahawked them. There was a certain John McKinley amongst the prisoners, formerly an officer in the 13th Virginia Regiment, whose head an old squaw cut off, and the Indians kicked it about upon the ground. The young Indian fellows came often where the colonel and I were and dashed the scalps in our faces. We were then conducted along towards the place where the colonel was afterwards executed. When we came within about half a mile of it, Simon Gertie met us with several Indians on horseback. He spoke to the colonel, but as I was about 150 yards behind, I could not hear what passed between them. Almost every Indian we met struck us, either with sticks or their fists. Gertie waited till I was brought up and asked, "Was that the doctor?" I told him yes, and went towards him, reaching out my hand. But he bid me be gone, and called me a damned rascal, upon which the fellows who had me in charge pulled me along. Gertie rode up after me and told me I was to go to the Shawnees towns. When we went to the fire, the colonel was stripped naked, ordered to sit down by the fire, and then they beat him with sticks and their fists. Presently, after I was treated in the same manner, they then tied a rope to the foot of a post about 15 feet high, bound the colonel's hands behind his back, and fastened the rope to the ligature between his wrists. The rope was long enough for him to sit down or walk around the post once or twice and return the same way. The colonel then called to Gertie and asked if they intended to burn him. Gertie answered yes. The colonel said he would take it all patiently. Upon this, Captain Pipe, a Delaware chief, made a speech to the Indians, viz. About 30 or 40 men, 60 or 70 squaws, and boys. When the speech was finished, they all yelled a hideous and hearty assent to what had been said. The Indian men then took up their guns and shot powder into the colonel's body from his feet as far up as his neck. I think not less than 70 loads were discharged upon his naked body. They then crowded about him and, to the best of my observation, cut off his ears. When the throng had dispersed a little, I saw the blood running from both sides of his head in consequence thereof. The fire was about 6 or 7 yards from the post to which the colonel was tied. It was made of small hickory poles, burnt quite through in the middle, each end of the poles remaining about 6 feet in length. 3 or 4 Indians, by turns, would take up, individually, one of these burning pieces of wood, and apply it to his naked body, already burnt black with the powder. These tormentors presented themselves on every side of him with the burning faggots and the poles. Some of the squaws took broad boards, upon which they would carry a quantity of burning coals and hot embers, and throw them on him, so that in short time he had nothing but coals of fire and hot ashes to walk upon. In the midst of these extreme tortures, he called to Simon Gertie and begged of him to shoot him. But Gertie, making no answer, he called to him again. Gertie then, by way of derision, told the colonel he had no gun, at the same time turning about to an Indian who was behind him, laughed heartily, and by all his gestures seemed delighted at the horrid scene. Gertie then came up to me and bade me prepare for death. He said, however, I was not to die at that place, but to be burnt at the Shawanese towns. He swore by God I need not expect to escape death, but should suffer it in all its extremities. He then observed that some prisoners had given him to understand that if our people had had him, they would not hurt him. For his part, he said, he did not believe it, but desired to know my opinion of the matter. But being at that time in great anguish and distress for the torments the colonel was suffering before my eyes, as well as the expectation of undergoing the same fate in 2 days, I made little or no answer. He expressed a great deal of ill will for Colonel Gibson, and said he was one of his greatest enemies, and more to the same purpose, to all which I paid very little attention. Colonel Crawford, at this point of his sufferings, besought the Almighty to have mercy on his soul, spoke very low, and bore his torments with the most manly fortitude. He continued in all the extremities of pain for 1 hour and 3 quarters, or 2 hours longer, as near as I can judge, when at last, being almost exhausted, he lay down on his belly. They then scalped him, and repeatedly threw the scalp in my face, telling me, "That was my great captain." An old squaw, whose appearance every way answered the ideas people entertain of the devil, got a board, took a parcel of coals and ashes, and laid them on his back and head, after he had been scalped. He then raised himself upon his feet, and began to walk around the post. They next put a burning stick to him, as usual, but he seemed more insensible of pain than before. The Indian fellow who had me in charge now took me away to Captain Pipe's house, about 3/4 of a mile from the place of the colonel's execution. I was bound all night, and thus prevented from seeing the last of the horrid spectacle. Next morning, being June 12th, the Indian untied me, painted me black, and we set off for the Shawanese town, which he told me was somewhat less than 40 miles from that place. We soon came to the spot where the colonel had been burnt. As it was partly in our way, I saw his bones lying amongst the remains of the fire, almost burnt to ashes. I suppose after he was dead, they had laid his body on the fire. The Indian told me that was my big captain, and gave the scalp halloo. He was on horseback and drove me before him. I pretended to this Indian I was ignorant of the death I was to die at the Shawanese towns, assumed as cheerful a countenance as possible, and asked him if we were not to live together as brothers in one house when we should get to the town. He seemed well pleased and said yes. He then asked me if I could make a wigwam. I told him I could, and he then seemed more friendly. We went that day, as near as I can judge, about 25 miles, the course partly southwest. The Indian told me we should next day come to the town, the sun being in such a direction, pointing nearly south. At night, when we went to rest, I attempted very often to untie myself, but the Indian was extremely vigilant, and scarcely ever shut his eyes that night. About daybreak, he got up and untied me. He next began to mend up the fire, and as the gnats were troublesome, I asked him if I should make a smoke behind him. He said yes. I then took the end of a dogwood fork, which had been burnt down to about 18 inches long. It was the longest stick I could find, yet too small for the purpose I had in view. Then I picked up another smaller stick, and taking a coal of fire between them, went behind him. Then, turning suddenly about, I struck him on the head with all the force I was master of, which so stunned him that he fell forward with both his hands into the fire. But seeing him recover and get up, I seized his gun while he ran off howling in a most fearful manner. I followed him with a determination to shoot him down, but pulling back the cock of the gun with too great violence, I believe I broke the main spring. I pursued him, however, about 30 yards, still endeavouring to fire the gun, but could not. Then going back to the fire, I took his blanket, a pair of new moccasins, his hops, powder horn, bullet bag, together with the gun, and marched off, directing my course towards the 5 o'clock mark. About half an hour before sunset, I came to the plains, which I think are about 16 miles wide. I laid me down in a thicket till dark, and then by the assistance of the North Star made my way through them and got into the woods before morning. I proceeded on the next day, and about noon crossed the paths by which our troops had gone out. These paths are nearly east and west, but I went due north all that afternoon with a view to avoid the enemy. In the evening I began to be very faint, and no wonder. I had been 6 days a prisoner, the last 2 days of which I had eaten nothing, and but very little the first 3 or 4. There were wild gooseberries in abundance in the woods, but being unripe, required mastication, which at that time I was not able to perform on account of a blow received from an Indian on the jaw with the back of a tomahawk. There was a weed that grew plentifully in that place, the juice of which I knew to be grateful and nourishing. I gathered a bundle of the same, took up my lodging under a large spreading beech tree, and having sucked plentifully of the juice, I went to sleep. And I think we'll leave that there for today. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for part 2 of Indian Atrocities.